That lovely worship that was beautiful. It was a lovely introduction, and particularly that last prayer of yours. Oh, there we go. Let's scroll down. I can see who we're talking to. Hi, my name is Trevor Downham, and I'm a friend of Nigel Horsfall's. We have been knowing each other since we were at school together, believe it or not. And Nigel was very clever at school. I wasn't that clever, but Horsfall was like the brain of the class, so I was proud to be associated as his friend. But it's really nice to be able to see him again and to be able to fellowship in your beautiful church. Jan, thank you for inviting me. Thank you, John, for allowing me to be here. Really cool. Thanks very much. Guys, what I want to do tonight is I'd rather have a conversation with you than preach a sermon at you, if that's all right. And if you want to come a little bit closer to feel more into it, then that would be good too. But you heard Jan just now talk about a generous God. He spoke about a God who doesn't do anything in half measures. A God who gives over and abundantly. We had verses that say he can do above what you either dream or think or imagine. We have a God who is able to be generous because he can do anything. And he can give to us exactly what he believes we need and what, in many cases, what we want. But it's this generous God that gives us, and Jan quoted that verse just now, in John 10, verse 10, where it says, I have to come to give you life, and can anybody finish it for me? Life more? Abundant. God wants us to give you life. He wants to give you abundant life. Let me take you back to the beginning of time, and human time anyway, in the context of Adam and Eve in the garden. There is another word in the Bible that they use for life, and it's the word bios or bios, whatever you want to call it. And it's the word we get biology. It's the human life. It's the life that I breathe and my heart pumps, and it's bios love. It's a human kind of a love. And then you have the other kind of a love, which they call a Zoe life, which is the word that Jesus used, Z-O-E, for an abundant life. He didn't just come to give us life. He came to give us life in extreme. He came to give us life generously. He came to give life in abundance. Now, it's easy to live in abundance, or it's easy to live an abundant life when you live in abundance. The Garden Eden was a place of great abundance. Eden, hey, wow, that's basic. Okay, in the Garden of Eden, it was easy to live an abundant life because everything was in abundance and was free for you, and you could have it as you wished because abundance was in the environment. But then after sin came into the world, God removed Adam and Eve very sadly. They broke his heart, and sin could not keep them together, so he moved them to a place called East of Eden. Okay, East of Eden. And East of Eden was a dry place. It was a tough place. There were thorns there. And they had to work by the sweat of their brow. And there was no more abundance in this place. If there was, you had to work for it. And even then, it was a tough thing to get. Because you're now living East of Eden. This is where we live right now. I don't know if you've noticed that. We're not in the garden anymore. We now live East of Eden. And then Jesus comes to this earth, and he promises us Zoe life. And the question that I have to ask is, can you live this Zoe life that Jesus promised to us while you're living East of Eden? Is that possible, that you can live a Zoe life, an abundant life, not the same life as you would have lived in the Garden of Eden? Can you live that abundant, generously receiving of God life, even when you are stuck in this place East of Eden? And that's what I would like to talk about tonight, because I believe you can. And I know we can because Jesus said we can. He's come to give us this Zoe life, even though we presently live East of Eden. Are you with me? Okay, so but this is one of those things where with every promise, there is a principle. God has promised us the abundant life. Now, I'm quite old now, and it's so nice to make association again with some of you guys. When did I know you? You must have been about 6 years old or something. Good night. And he was in my daughter's class at school, and we've known each other for many years, and to see some of you again is, I'm really old, and I have the benefit of retrospect. So many of the things that I will be sharing with you are things that maybe I wish I'd done better, maybe I wish I'd found and tapped into this Zoe life from a different dynamic, but I haven't, but I still know how I could have done it. But for you young oaks, I'm so chuffed that you are here tonight, because if you listen to what this old man has to say, you may not make the same mistakes as this old man has made. Okay, so listen carefully, because with Zoe life comes some conditions. With Zoe life, if you want to live the Zoe life, it doesn't happen automatically. He doesn't just give you abundant life. He gives you the potential to have abundant life. He gives us life, spiritual life, to give us saved anyway. But the abundant life is in a different category. You have got to do something to you never earn this, but you've got to something to do to affirm this abundant life. Now, I want to draw to you a familiar sign. What is that? That's a noughts and cross sign, is it not? Okay. And because you're not that bright, I have to draw pictures for you tonight. Now, they tell me, if they go to Bible school, John will tell you that the average person can't take in more than 9 concepts in one sitting. Some people can't take in 2, but most people can't take in more than 9. And funnily enough, there are 9 concepts here that I would like to paint for you in relation to us taking ownership of Zoe life. Now, some of these things I have learned over the course of many years. Some of you have still got to learn these things. But if you want to have Zoe life, the first thing you've got to do is, according to Paul, you've got to fight. Anybody want to finish that one? You've got to fight the good fight. That's a boxing glove, by the way. Okay. You've got to fight the good fight. As I look back over my years, I look at some of the things, the fights that I have fought. And I look back and I say, was that a fight worth fighting? Because I lost my joy in the context of that fight. I lost the Zoe experience of the abundant life because I was too busy fighting for something that was not a good fight. Now, by insinuation, because there are good fights, there are probably also bad fights. You know, Jesus fought a good fight, did he not? Let me tell you what a good fight looks like. When you fight on the cause of those who stand in injustice, that's a good fight. Jesus was always doing that. That's why he went to the temple that day and he threw over the tables, remember? And he fought a really good fight on behalf of those who could not fight for themselves. That's always a good fight. Jesus fought a really good fight on behalf of children. And he had children, the disciples wanted to chase them away. And Jesus said, no, bring those kids to me. And he took the kids upon his lap. He had time for the children. He fought on their behalf. That's a good fight. Jesus fought a good fight on behalf of a woman caught in adultery. Everybody wanted to judge her, and they wanted to throw stones and kill her. But Jesus stood on her behalf. He stood in her, and he fought on behalf of this woman who by the law should in fact have died. That was a good fight. Jesus stood well and fought strong on behalf of a leper who came to him. And in those days, leprosy was a terrible disease. It was contagious. And if you touched anybody with leprosy, that was it, your history. You're going to go and live in the leper colony out of town. You're going to be rejected. You're going to be ostracized because you've got this dreaded disease. One day, a leper came to Jesus very nervously because he thought maybe if he gets caught, he's going to be stoned because that's what they did. And he would have his killed, and he would have his leg tied with a rope and dragged out of town. He knew he was taking his life in his hands when he came to Jesus. He said, hey, Jesus, you know, I was really taking my life in my hands here, but I really believe that you could heal me. And then we read how Jesus did the strangest of things, things you never do to lepers. He reached out, and he touched the guy. And here's the people, the disciples, looking at Jesus and saying, what is he doing? You know, Jesus, we like you. You feed us. You heal us. You make our blind eyes open. Jesus, don't touch the leper. Don't touch the leper. Don't touch the leper. And here we see Jesus walking towards the leper. And I get this picture of the disciples saying, Jesus, where are you going? And he says, no, I'm just going to talk to the leper over here. Is that all right? And they're, no, Jesus, not all right. Jesus, come back and be with us. In fact, Jesus, let's throw stones at the leper. Let's form a big circle. Jesus, here's a few stones. You can throw some stones at the leper if you like too, because we know how to deal with lepers. And Jesus walked up this leper. He didn't just talk to him, but the scripture says he reached out and he touched him. And the disciples said, Jesus, what are you doing? And the touch insinuates not just a, touch. It reads, he reached out and he embraced this man. He hadn't experienced a human touch probably for years. Everybody had ostracized him, kicked him out of town, and rejected him from society until Jesus came along. Jesus fought a great fight on behalf of that leper. There are also some stupid fights that you've got to avoid, guys. You've got to avoid the fight that Saul had with David. You know, Saul wanted to kill David. Why do you want to kill him? Because he was jealous of him. And David was rising up. Instead of Saul looking at him and saying, man, he's God's anointed. Let me make him the best he can be. Saul became jealous. Do you remember the song that clinched the deal? They'd been out to battle and they were coming back. and they heard the woman of the town singing, and Saul heard, hey, Saul has killed his thousands. And Saul is stoked with that. But then he hears the next line, and it says that David has killed his 10,000s. Yes, and Saul didn't like that. And the beginning of his demise happened at the point of his jealousy over the, he fought a bad fight. What about the fight between Mary and Martha in the kitchen and in the house, where Martha was saying, you know, hey Jesus, you know, Mary was saying, hey Jesus, Martha, what, you know, what, when's Martha going to come and help me in the kitchen? You know, when is she going to help me? She sat at your feet, or Mary sat at your feet all this time. Martha's in the kitchen, and we always have this fight. It's a stupid fight between the workers and the worshippers. Have you ever noticed that? In a church, we often have that. Oh, the worshippers are so spiritually minded, they're of no earthly use. Have you heard that? You know? And then the people who want to work, and we have to work, we have to clean this, we have to paint the church, we have to cut the lawn. And they always seem, it's a stupid fight. I hope in your church you don't fight that fight, because that's a very stupid fight. And then we have the fight that took place between James and John with Jesus, where they came to Jesus and said, hey, Jesus, it's a private little meeting over here quickly. You know, when you get to heaven, Jesus, and into your glory, would it be cool if James and John sat next to, could we sit on your left and your right hand? You know, don't worry about the disciples, Jesus. We are the dudes. You want to hang with us, you know? And Jesus put them in their place because they were going in the face of their friends and the other. That's a bad fight. That would elevate your ego. It's always a dumb fight to fight on behalf of that. So there are good fights and there are bad fights. In my experience, I would far rather have looked back and said, man, I fought a few fights that I should never have fought. All they did was take the abundant life that I could have had, and they made me bitter, they made me cynical and sarcastic, and nobody wants to be like that at the end of the day. So my advice to you, if you want to keep the Zoe life, is fight the good fight. You got that? The second thing that I would like to suggest to you, if you want to keep the Zoe life, is you got to fly closer to the flame. You've got to fly close to the flame of God's holiness. Our God is a raging fire. And we don't like fire, so we like to keep it a distance from fire. But God says, come close. Let me burn all the rubbish off your life. Let me accentuate your holiness. Let me get rid of those bad attitudes and that negativity and those sinful habits. Come close to me. Let me tell you, the closer you get to God, the more uncomfortable it becomes, because he's a consuming fire. And that's good if you will come close. I love the story in Isaiah 6 of Isaiah, where he came to the temple that day, remember? And it says he walked in the temple, and he says, I saw the Lord, and he was high and lifted up. And the angels were crying, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. And then they said, what did you do when you saw the Lord holy? He says, man, I fell flat on my face. I couldn't do anything but when you stand in the presence of a holy God, there's only one place where you is flat on your face on the floor. And then he heard the voice saying, stand up. And as he stood up, the altar, fire was taken from the altar, the coal, and came and seared his lips and burnt away all the rubbish. Because most of the rubbish that we have comes out of our mouths, stuff we say. And this came and seared as he got closer to the holiness of God. And then you notice this. At the end of the cleansing, when the fire had come and cleansed him as he had walked close to the flame of God's holiness, then God says, hey, who will go for us? Who can I send into this world? And at that point, Isaiah smiles and says, Lord, send me. You've got to fly closer to the flame of God's holiness. It can be a painful place to be, an uncomfortable place to be. But if you want to be used of God, young people, listen carefully. Don't mess with sin. Avoid it. Let God burn it off your life. And you get closer to his holiness and let allow him to burn all that rubbish away. Does that one make sense? Anybody want to say anything? Anybody want to argue with me? That'd be fun. You're right. Okay, here's the next one. The next one I want you to do is face the fact. So far, we're going to fight the good fight. We're going to fly closer to the flame. And the next one that I want to suggest to you is that we've got to face some facts. We're doing these F thing. Now, here's the fact. Let me suggest to you this, that as we face just one fact, that God often does His best work in the dark. In the darkness of some of the tragedies that happened in your life, God does His best work. Back in creation, we read this, that when God did something, He revealed in the light what He had made in the night. And there was the morning and evening, and then there was morning, remember? Of the first, second, third, fourth, seventh day. And He revealed in the light what He had made in the darkness of the night. That's interesting. Because I wonder if that principle isn't true in our lives. That at the end of us going through the valley of the shadow of death, darkness, disappointment, despair, disillusionment, depression, at the end of going through all of those dark valleys, what comes out at the end can, doesn't always necessarily have to be, but can come out so much better than the one that came in. God often does His best work in the dark. I've seen this in my own life. I've seen it in the lives of the people that I love in my church and the people that I counsel with in the darkness of their lives. I'm looking forward with anticipation to one day them stepping into the light and God revealing in the light what He did for them in the night. I see it all the time. Have a look at Job. Man, no one went through darker times than that dude. You know, that guy went through incredible pain and suffering and hardship. His kids were taken from him, his business. Everything just went gone in a very short period of time. But look at the man at the end. And what God did in the darkness of his disappointment and despair, the product at the end was 10 times better than the product that was before. And we have this beautiful picture of God taking us through the fires. And He says, I will purge you with fire. I'll get rid of all the junk as you walk closer to my holiness. And I will do my best work in the dark. Don't be afraid of dark times. And I'm not saying that lightly, because I don't want to belittle some of the pain that some of you have already been through. I don't want to make light of that. But I do want to tell you this, that when you get that phone call that says, man, you know, something terrible has happened. There's been an accident. Somebody's been killed. Or you get the report from the doctor say you've got a horrible disease. And you step into the time of darkness. You can smile to know that if you do it right, what comes out the other side will be far better because God does His best work in the dark. Don't forget it. Anybody want to comment on that one? You guys need to talk to me. It's okay to talk in church. You know that, hey? Okay. Is anybody got an experience of that? Have you got one? Do you want to tell us about it? Good. But what will come out at the end will be better than what went in. You must know that. That's so cool. Thank you. All right, let's do the next one. Okay, how do I draw this thing? Okay. He's grinning in his teeth. He's only got one eye. The other eye is stitched up. This dude has only got one ear. The other one has been kind of ripped off. But he is sweating. It's a brilliant picture. Eh? It was for you. Like that one? Okay. The theme of this one is don't sweat the small stuff. Don't fuss. If we're going to stay with the F, don't fuss over the frivolous. Oh, man, we fuss over frivolous stuff, do we not? We fuss over the things that don't matter. We fuss over where we're going to put the powers in church. One lady wants it there. The other one wants it there. And we fuss over the stupidest of things. And we fuss over issues of personal preference, over issues of principle. And we make so much hardship and pain for people around us because we fuss over the frivolous. And we sweat the small stuff. In the Bible, there's this remarkable guy, David, the king. Before he was made king, he was running from King Saul, who was after him. Do you remember that? And King Saul was jealous of him, wanted to kill him. One day David runs off and he finds himself in a cave. He thinks nobody knows that he's there. It's so cool. He's hiding there and he thinks, I'm all alone. I'm going to sleep tonight and no one knows that I'm here. But the next morning he goes to the mouth of the cave and there's 400 people standing there. And it tells you what these first 400 people were looking like. They looked like this. You know, they were the motliest crew. Some of them had convict records. Some of them were in debt and had run away. So one guy had only one eye, the other guy only had one ear, and the guy only had one leg. And these 400 people are standing in front of David at the cave, and there's not one superstar amongst them. There's not a single superstar, nobody really of any merit or of anything in these 400 people. And they're standing there and they say, "Hey, David, hey, David." And they say, "What do you guys want?" "Hey, hey, David, can you make of us a great army?" And David looks at this crowd and says, "You make of you an army?" David says, "Of course I can do that." And the guy says, "But David, haven't you noticed I'm kind of deaf over here?" And the guy says, "Well, I've only got one eye, I can only see over here. You know, I've only got one leg, I can't walk very fast." David said, "I'm not going to sweat the frivolous stuff. I'm not going to fuss over the frivolous. I'm not going to sweat. I'm going to make of you a great army." And we realize how this great leader turned those 400 scoundrels, rascals, and half-baked people, people who had been rejected from the town and from society, David turned those 400 people into a formidable force. He didn't sweat the small stuff or fuss over the frivolous. I don't know if you've noticed that the church is not made up of many. There are a number, but they often get themselves into trouble. Superstars. Have you noticed that? We're all average, hey? Very average people. You know, and because, you know, God doesn't need superstars, because a superstar can turn into a shooting star if he doesn't control himself. And we have these superstars stand up, they're not in control, and before you know it, they're a shooting star, and they're gone. You know, God does not need people like that. He just needs plain, average, broken people like you and me. And God is able. If David could do it, how much more can't God make something special out of the motley crew that is his church, because he doesn't fuss over the frivolous, and because he doesn't, we shouldn't either. There's lots of frivolous stuff that goes on around that we have to be careful about. Okay, let me do another one here quickly. Okay, I'll draw this one. It's not a cross. It's a garment. Okay, it's a jacket. It's a coat. Okay, and it's on this guy, and he's, for some reason, he's got Zoe life. So he's a happy young man. Okay. Let me suggest you don't fashion, that's the garment thing, on the familiar. Don't fashion on the familiar. Because we get so easy. God is a changing God. If we had to stay the way we always were, we're not going anywhere, baby. We're staying exactly the same we are. God is wanting us to change, never changing our principles or the things that we hold dear. He's never violating a theology that he's established in concrete, but he does want us to be adaptable in our lives. The greatest picture of this, especially with the idea of the cloak, is Joseph. Remember Joseph? He started off life wearing the robe of significance, the coat of many colors. They took the robe of significance off him, and they put the robe of slavery on him. They made him a slave. Then one day they took the robe of slavery off him and they put on him the robe of stewardship. Now he's moving up the ladder. Then they took the robe of stewardship off him and they put the robe of subjection on him. Now he's a prisoner. He's continually changing robes. But he doesn't change his principles, his ideals, his faith in God does not change no matter what the circumstances were. When he was in the prison, they took the robe of this horrible subjection and eventually they put the robe of sublimity on him. And he became the prime minister. He was always changing robes. But he never changed himself. Now, we live in a church environment that us old guys, we don't like change. You know that, hey? Yo. We want to do it like we always did it, hey? Because we're comfortable with that. Don't stretch us too much, you know? But I have to tell you, I'm not suggesting you be stupid about this. But I'm suggesting that for us old guys, there has to be an ability to adapt and to change and to move forward, not compromise. You don't have to compromise anything in order to be able to accommodate, and don't get too familiar with the fashion of the day, because fashions change. But you know what also happens in fashions? You guys are wearing the same clothes that I wore when I was your age, except for the bell-bottom things. Remember, Nigel, you used to wear bell-bottoms. Hey? They were cool. They will come back. They will absolutely come back, because fashion goes in a circle. And now the stuff that you think you're so cool. Man, I used to wear clothes like you when I was your age. But the fashions have changed and they've always come back. And you thought that you'd invented this stuff, eh? Baggy pants and no socks. We used to wear like that, you know? But it's been a transition of many changes to come back to where it began. Church, don't be afraid of change. Don't change for change's sake. That's stupid. But when God allows you and evolves change in you, do not fashion too much upon the familiar. You don't need a change, but the familiarity with your circumstances may just need to be adjusted. Let me do another one here. What about this one? Nigel, you will never get this one. You'll never guess it. And then, that's a fan. You know fans that women... Yes, I'm really bad tonight. Okay, it's a fan. In the church today, there are two types of people. You've heard this before, I'm sure. You get fans and you get followers. You'll know you're a follower because you're carrying a cross. Jesus said, if you want to follow me, what? Take up your cross and follow me. But there are a lot of people who come to church today who are just fans. Jesus has always had fans. When he fed 5,000 people, I'm going to tell you, he had lots of fans. When he raised the dead, healed the sick, made the blind see and the deaf to hear, he had plenty of fans. And they would follow him and they would cheer for him. Go, Jesus! Go, yay, for Jesus! And then when Jesus would demand something of them, they'd say, oh, no. I have to sacrifice something. Actually, no, I'd rather just be a fan at a distance. There are not many followers in church today, but there are a heck of a lot of fans. And one of the things that we have to work at is who we are. Are we fans or are we true followers? Because a fan is somebody who just wants to get something out of Jesus. Remember when Jesus healed, fed the thousands of people, the next day he went across the sea, and the same thousands of people had all the way around the sea to where Jesus was? And Jesus said, hey, I've not seen you guys before. And yeah, Jesus, we were there yesterday when you fed us all. And Jesus, what do you want? No, you're hoping you're going to feed us again today? Just a bunch of fads. And then Jesus gave them that verse. He says, anybody who wants to follow me, take up his cross, and a cross means sacrifice. You see me walking downtown here carrying a cross, you know I'm going to die. I'm not going to a Sunday school picnic. I'm going to die because a cross is a symbol of death. And when Paul says, I am crucified with Christ, you know what he's saying, hey, I have died to myself. Physically, I'm still alive. We know that. But I've died to my ego. That's a painful thing. I've died to my agenda and my vision and that which I've died to all of that in order to pursue the purpose and the cause of Christ. That's the difference between a fan who just wants to cheer for Jesus and hope that he gets something in the meanwhile. Jesus, will you heal me? Well, probably not. Oh, well, then I'm just going to go home, you know. And you get fans, but then you get followers who are saying, Lord, I'm going to lay down my life for you. Sadly, the 80-20 rule will probably apply. 80% of the people that we hang out with are just fans. And when things are tough and these demands, they'll leave. They did with Jesus. One of the most tragic verses after Jesus said, take up your cross and follow me, it says this, and many left from following him that day. Why? They were just fans. They just wanted to get something out of Jesus. Gee, my time is gone. I better rush. Okay. What about this one? You guys need to learn what it means to... frame the famous. Frame the famous. We all need role models. You know, if I had in my office to have a picture like Hebrews 11, God's wall of fame, there's Abraham. He's got a wall of fame of all his heroes of the faith, Abraham and Samson and all those great guys. And God has this wall of fame. In our house, we have a wall of family. You don't have to be famous to be on our wall. You just got to be family, you know, and have your picture up there. But in God, he has this wall of fame, his heroes of the faith that God says, these are my men over here. These are the men and the women who have shaped the Bible and the church and everything that I love. And I think we should have the same thing. If I had to have pictures of people who were on my wall of fame, you know who would be on there? My wife would be on there, number one. Because she's got to put up with me. She must be some kind of hero, you know. Then I would have Billy Graham. And who wouldn't have Billy Graham on their wall of fame, you know? I certainly would. And then, you know, I don't care what your doctrine is, but I would have Mother Teresa up there. I love Mother Teresa. Oh, my word, that heart of compassion and that heart of love. And I'm saying, God, that is just so cool, man. I want to be like her. And we frame the famous. I would have a guy by the name of Tony Campola up there. I love Tony Campola. You know, everything he says I agree with except a few things. But that guy, 20 years ago, shaped my philosophy of ministry. He totally did. I would have a picture of the 70-year-old bald man called Tony Campolo up on my wall because he shaped who I was. And I often used to think, man, that guy, he gave me such great counsel. I didn't have to meet him. I met him once, you know, and I was so privileged to meet the guy. But he shaped my ministry, shaped the person that I am. We need to frame the fame. I'm not saying you put them on a pedestal. You know that, hey? Because there's only one who will stand in center stage. And when he stands on center stage, he stands alone. Not even Moses is going to stand with Jesus on center stage. But it's okay for us to learn from people who come into our lives, and it's okay that we frame the famous. But please don't put them on pedestals, because when they fall, you're going to fall as well. Okay, here's a quick one. This is a big one, but we haven't got too much time to talk about it. We've got to forgive. This guy's fallen down. I'm trying to make a shadow there. Okay. You've got to forgive the fallen. Over the course of your years, young people, there's going to come people into your life who are going to hurt you. You know that, eh? There's going to come people into your life who are going to mess you up. There's going to be people in your life who are going to say nasty things about you that may or may not be true, but what the heck. You're going to have people who come into your life who trash some of the things that you hold dear. You're going to have that if you haven't had it already. Some of you may have. But the Bible teaches very emphatically that as victorious as you may be, you need to forgive those who have fallen. You know the story of the prodigal son? The saddest part of that story is the brother. He couldn't forgive his fallen brother. And at the end of the day, he was probably the most bitter, twisted person that you could ever meet. You don't want to become like that. And if you don't forgive the people who mess you up, you will become like that. And you don't want that to happen to you. The brother who came back and he judged his brother. He said, "You've trashed all Dad's inheritance. You've lost it all for us. I'm never going to talk to you again." Meanwhile, the father had welcomed him home, man, and said, "How can I treat you as a slave? You're my son. I'm going to give you back everything." And that's the attitude that we need to have when we forgive the fallen, those who have messed us up. That's a big deal. That's a sermon all on its own. And then the last one that I want to suggest to you is we need to focus on the final. Now that's easy. That's a bucket. At the end of Paul's life, Apostle Paul, 2 Timothy chapter 4, he's sitting in a horrible prison cell and he's waiting to die. And he says this. He says, "I'm all poured out. You know, I have run the race. I've kept the faith. I have done all that stuff, those big three things that we need to have done. I've run the race, kept the faith, and whatever the third one was." And he says, "Now I'm ready to go. My bucket is empty." You see, when you were born, you were given a bucket that was full. By the time you leave this world, there's nothing more tragic you need to know than a half-empty bucket or a bucket that is still half-full. When God has given so much ability and talent and gift to you guys, and you'd end your life with still half of it in the bucket. Paul is looking at the bucket of his life and saying, "It's empty, not a drop left. I am ready to go." Man, I want to die like that. That's how I want to go. So I'm not going to go out with a little puff of smoke. Ooh. I'm going to go out with a blaze of glory, baby, where every drop is gone. There is nothing left. I gave a speech to some of our men in the church the other day about retirement. I'm saying, go blow your nose. Retirement is just a non-entity. I never find it in the Bible. I find people who live right through to the end and they died with their boots on. And if you retire, you die. Something happens psychologically and spiritually inside of you and even physically. You die when you think that you can declare your own end. We got to go right through to the end. That's easy for me to say because I'm nearly there. I'm three quarters dead, so I'm happy to say. But you guys still got your whole life set. You've got to plan to empty that bucket so when it's all said and done and the curtain closes, you can say like Paul, "I'm all poured out. Henceforth, there is a crown of righteousness which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me." That's focusing on the final when God will give to you that crown of righteousness. Have you got it? Okay, now you can go home. But before you go home, You gotta say this out loud. Remember all the F's. You've got to, first of all, fight the good fight. Then you've got to fly. Thank you. Somebody's listening. Fly closer to the flame. And then this one was? Face the facts. Good one. That God does his best work in the dark. This one. Don't sweat the small stuff. Don't fuss over the frivolous. Okay. This one. Okay. This one. Fan or follower. This one. Frame the famous. This one. Forgive the fallen. And this one. Finish with flair or whatever you want to say. I don't care. Okay. Have you got it? That was fun. Okay. We're going to pray. Let's pray. Father, thank you for tonight. This has been fun. And thank you that you're such an abundant God and you give us so generously. You give us life and you give us the possibility of life in abundance. We have to embrace that. We don't just own it, we embrace it. And in order for us to embrace it, we have to do these 9 things and probably a whole lot of other ones. But Lord, I pray for these young people tonight that they'd remember, even if it's just one of the things we've suggested tonight, Lord, I pray that it may be something that would shape them to become everything that you would want for them to be, that they may experience the abundant Zoe life of God. That's our prayer tonight, Lord, and we pray it in Jesus' name with great expectation that you'll help us to this end. And we ask it in your name. Amen.